This is the fifth episode of the Lymphoma Podcasts from the British Society of Haematology Lymphoma Special Interest Group. My name is Bernard Mabry. I'm a trainee in the West Midlands, and I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Matt Ahern from Leicester, who's going to talk with me about T-cell lymphomas, specifically the nodal T-cell lymphomas. And so without any ado, I'm going to introduce our first case, Matt, which is a 39-year-old man who presented with a groin lump. And he underwent a core biopsy, and that showed a diffuse infiltrate of pleomorphic cells with kidney-shaped nuclei, strong CD30 expression, negative for ALK, consistent with anaplastic large cell lymphoma. And he had a PET CT scan that demonstrated avid lymph nodes on both sides of the diaphragm, and multifocal bone marrow avidity. I think it's quite typical of most T-cell lymphomas in that disease was fairly advanced at presentation. But ALK-negative ALCL is quite a heterogeneous group of diseases, really. And I wonder if you could just talk us through the different ways in which we need to kind of refine the diagnosis here.
Yeah, thank you, Bernard. So, I mean, you clearly describe a fairly classic case of anaplastic large cell lymphoma with that distinct morphological appearance and universal and strong CD30. And that's really a hallmark of both ALK positive and ALK negative ALCL, that strong and uniform CD30 expression. And collectively, ALCL represents around 20% of T-cell lymphoma. But we divide them, as you've already alluded to, by the presence or absence of ALK. We use an immunohistochemistry marker, which is a very good surrogate for the genomic rearrangement that defines the ALK status. And within ALK-negative anaplastic large cell lymphoma, increasingly, and this applies across the board with T-cell lymphoma, we're appreciating greater disease heterogeneity. And people have been attempting to try and identify further markers that can help advance our ability to determine a patient's prognosis, outcome, and best treatment pathway. And I think the two examples that have emerged for ALK-negative anaplastic large cell lymphoma include rearrangements in TP63, and that's fairly rare. It only occurs in 5 to 10% of cases, but it appears to be associated with an extremely poor clinical outcome. In contrast, rearrangements in the gene DUSP22 have been reported to be associated with a much more favourable outcome, even more similar to the favourable outcome that we see with ALK-positive anaplastic large cell lymphoma. And both of these two rearrangements can be detected by FISH on tissue samples. But just a word of caution, I think, there's an enthusiasm to adopt, novel biomarkers, but the number of cases where clinical outcomes have been looked with DUST22, for example, still quite small, probably only 50 or 60 internationally reported to date. With long-term clinical outcomes. And whilst there is some enthusiasm to decide whether we can use DUST22 status to determine transplantation decisions, for example, I think we do need further validation and ideally prospective validation. And certainly a study from the Canadians did not demonstrate that DUST22 patients did as well as other earlier reports. So those are some of the emerging molecular delineations that are coming through for ALK-negative disease.
And do those molecular groups, are they still present in the other sort of non-systemic forms like breast implant associated and cutaneous ALCL? Perhaps the numbers aren't there to really identify.
Yeah, so certainly in primary cutaneous disease, there have been reports of DUST22. I'm not aware. I mean, breast implant associated ALCL is... Is extremely rare, and I'm not aware that there's been any clear studies there. I mean, breast implant ALCL seems to be an abnormal host reaction due to the silicon implants. Interesting biology.
And As you allude to, you know, the use of DAS22 to stratify transplant decisions perhaps is quite controversial given the paucity of the data so far. But in general, how do you go about treating a sort of typical ALK-negative ALCL in this day and age?
Yeah. So I think the outcomes for ALK-negative ALCL are poor. They're similar to peripheral T-cell lymphoma, NOS, and angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma. Slightly better, 40% 5-year survivals in the International T-cell Project. The standard treatment approach has recently changed, and that's as a result of the Echelon 2 style. So this trial, so this randomized CD30 positive patients, CD30 expression had to be over 10%. To either standard CHOP or the experimental arm, which was the anti-CD30 antibody drug conjugate brentuximab vedotin combined with CHIP. So that's CHOP chemotherapy without vincristine to mitigate the neurotoxicity risk. And there was a clear significant benefit in both progression-free and overall survival at follow-up. And at 5 years, the overall survival uplift was 9%. So this was, you know, a significant advance on historical treatment. A couple of key points about that is that although it took all CD30 positive PTCLs, 75% of enrolled patients had systemic anaplastic large cell lymphoma. And that wasn't because they were trying to load the study in any way. That was a regulatory requirement that they had to meet for licensing reasons. So I think I make that point because in Europe and NICE approval is restricted to the use of systemic anaplastic large cell lymphoma, whereas the FDA approval allows brentuximab vedotin to be used across all CD30 T-cell lymphoma subtypes. So that's certainly, I think, now that is the standard of care. That's how I would treat someone. I would give 6 cycles of BV CHIP. And monitor closely for neurotoxicity. I tend to use primary prophylactic G-CSF given a febrile neutropenia rate around 20% with this regimen.
Thanks. In our centre, we talked about using the Echelon 2 regimen for other CD30 positive disease, but I think at the moment, certainly the licensing and the funding is confined to the anaplastic population.
That's right. And Bernadette, when you the study wasn't powered to look at subgroups, as always.
No, of course.
But there was no clear benefit for NOS and AITL. And in fact, the hazard ratio for AITL was greater than 1, suggesting the opposite. But yeah. Of course, it was underpowered. So it doesn't exclude a benefit, but it certainly doesn't confirm a benefit in those subtypes. There is a randomized study, international global study, looking at low CD30 expressing T-cell lymphoma subtypes. So that will not include anaplastic large cell lymphoma. So we are going to get more data on that particular area that you've just covered.
Yeah, well, that would be interesting to see. I think we might move on to another case, just to broaden the scope, and this is a 40-year-old Jamaican woman who presented initially with a 1-year history of pruritus and skin papules, but then it presented acutely to ED with worsening breathlessness. She had nodular skin lesions on examination at that time, and a CT showed widespread pulmonary nodules as well as axillary lymphadenopathy. And a core biopsy of an axillary node showed diffuse effacement with large atypical CD4 positive T cells. They were CD7 negative, CD25 positive, and a subset were CD30 positive. She also underwent a skin biopsy, which showed atypical dermal and perianexal large atypical lymphocytes. Now, the diagnostics in T cell lymphoma is pretty fraught. Would you be able to make a diagnosis at this point with the information we had at that point?
Yes, I think this case highlights the importance of not just the pathological histological assessment, but also the clinical context and interpretation. So if you had a lymph node with atypical T cells, and you know the loss of CD7 is a clue to aberrancy, and no other clinical information, you know, it's very difficult to make any diagnosis. And we know that you can have aberrant atypical lymphocytes in the setting of a QTBV, for example. Clearly, we've got a clinical description that is consistent with, you know, lymphoproliferative disorder, and we've got an abnormal T cell infiltrate. So, you know, together, that's, you know, this is extremely suspicious. Usually we would send off the TCR clonality to get confirmation that those T cells are clonal, although that again in isolation isn't diagnostic. You can get T cell clones in acute viral infections, for example. So it's really important that at the MDTs or outside of the MDTs, often we engage with our pathology colleagues, and we provide them with clinical information, because of course I don't know how it works at your center, but you know, we ask interventional radiology for a biopsy. They don't transcribe all the clinical information that we have onto the request forms, and so it's often lacking. They often don't get the full clinical picture. And then in addition to the clinical picture, there's also ancillary tests and other diagnostic workup investigations that pathologists may not be aware of necessarily. And so it's important that we highlight those where they're critical or key.
What additional tests do you think we should be doing at this point to home in on a specific diagnosis?
The clinical presentation describe in terms of firstly the patient demographic and the cutaneous manifestations along with pulmonary nodules and lymph nodes. You know, it'd be really important to do an HTLV-1 screen in this case. Now, my view is that we should be doing an HTLV-1 test on every case of possible or confirmed T-cell lymphoma. And certainly if you speak to the National HTLV-1 Service, they've recently had a few, you know, white British Caucasians and who have turned out to be HTLV-1 carriers. So I don't think we can just look at individuals from endemic areas, which is South America, Japan, the Caribbean, and Africa, for example. And we've got data for this. We know in the International T-Cell Project, the single biggest reason for the diagnosis to be altered was when the pathologist was told what the HTLV-1 status is. So under the microscope, ATLL looks like peripheral T-cell lymphoma and often like peripheral T-cell lymphoma NOS. But when you provide that extra information, the pathologist is able to come up with the correct diagnosis. It's not just about the histopathology.
So this lady did have positive HTLV-1 serology. And she also had flow formed on peripheral blood, despite having a completely normal white count and white cell differential. But that flow did reveal an aberrant immunophenotype of CD4 T cells that were CD25 positive, CD52 positive, but CD7 negative, which again is consistent with the diagnosis of ATLL. Outcomes aren't good for ATLL, and treatment is often complicated by the sort of comorbidity, acute illness, and their immune system's state. I wonder if you could just walk us through the different elements of treatment.
Yes, sure, absolutely, and you're quite right. And I think when you're thinking about treatment, you know, you need to understand the poor prognosis, because that's, you know, it informs the treatment approaches that we adopt in the UK. So the prognosis is dire. It really is. And with that, so I should maybe take a step back, so that there are different clinical variants of ATL. What we're discussing here is an acute aggressive type, of which there are two forms, lymphoma type and acute ATLL with more leukemic involvement. With standard chemotherapy for bulky acute ATLL or lymphoma type alone, the long-term survival is no more than 10%, really poor. 90% of patients will experience chemotherapy treatment failure. And so that's really important to understand. So when we think about goals of therapy, really in the UK, the intent is to start on combination chemotherapy. We can talk about that in a second. But to get the patient into a sufficient remission that allows us, where appropriate, to undertake an allogeneic stem cell transplant. Because with chemotherapy alone, the outcomes are so poor. They're still poor even, you know, if we get patients to an allograft, but they're certainly better, and we may achieve long-term survivals in approximately 30%. So most people would use CHOP-based chemotherapy. There has been some trials in Japan looking at more intensive regimens. They don't appear to demonstrate an overall survival benefit. The CNS risk in ATLL is quite significant. It's in around 10 to 20%, which is high. And many people would look to try and deliver systemic CNS prophylaxis through high-dose methotrexate. In fact, I had a discussion with Dr. Lucy Cook, who really is the kind of international expert on ATLL, about the recent data that's come through from DLBCL and whether we should still be intercalating, so that's delivering the high-dose methotrexate during CHOP chemotherapy cycles or at the end of treatment, which has been suggested. But certainly her opinion is that, you know, the high rates and the lack of evidence otherwise supports intercalation.
Given what you said about prognosis and, you know, the paucity of good data, should these patients all be referred to one of a handful of centres to try to centralise, you know, their treatment, but also like trials delivery in this small...
I think it's a really good point. So I think with ATLL specifically, we don't get lots of cases, but I discuss every case with the HTLV1 national service. So there's a nationally commissioned HTLV1 service based at Imperial. And Dr. Lucy Cook kind of leads from a hematology point of view and offers extremely sound advice and support as we manage these very complex patients. What's more is that the HTLV1 service will offer consultation with the patient to discuss the HTLV1 aspects of things, and that can be remote. So my case list this year, that was offered remotely. And there's wider issues here in terms of family screening and, you know, contacting family members, discussing risks and, you know, taking blood samples to look at their HTLV1 status as well. So I think it's really important that anyone who has a case of ATLL engages with the service there.
It sounds like they won't be too involved in anti-lymphoma therapy specifically.
No.
But they would still advise on trial availability or not?
Yeah, even... absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because, the team at Imperial often, you know, look to have a portfolio that feels the need for these patients. And unfortunately, trials are still few and far between. But yes, they're able to. But they can also give advice about relapse refractory treatment options, sometimes compassionate drug options as well. And, you know, that's helpful because it's keeping current for even across lymphoma. As a lymphoma specialist can be quite challenging, let alone for anyone who's dealing with other blood disorders as well. So it's important to, I think, engage with, you know, the individuals that are at the forefront of their field.
And in terms of actually treating the viral infection, how is that prioritized versus giving immunosuppressive chemotherapy?
Yeah, and that's a really good question because, you know, sometimes you read the textbooks and the articles and, you know, you get the impression that zidovudine and interferon that we use to, you know, try and reduce the viral load, you know, are absolutely critical. But it actually depends on the clinical features of your ATLL. So these are the viral directed therapies are very good in the kind of cutaneous and leukemic setting, but they're less effective with bulky nodal disease. And the definition of bulk in ATLL is slightly different. It's probably around 3 centimeters. Really what we're trying to do is identify the lymphoma types with that definition. And you run the risk of you run the risk of developing cytopenias, combining zidovudin interferon with CHOP-based chemotherapy. And I think it comes back to, you know, treatment goals, and you know, systemic chemotherapy delivery is critically important. And these patients are often sick at the start as well. So our last case, we actually focused on giving CHOP. We had a couple of delays with neutropenia alone, and we were planning to start zidovudin and interferon after completing CHOP pending allogeneic stem cell transplant. Unfortunately, the individual progressed very quickly. And that was, again, you know, that was discussions with colleagues and particularly the HLV1 service. So, you know, it's definitely, there's some data there to support it. The efficacy is less in significant nodal bulk, and we don't want to significantly hamper systemic chemotherapy delivery.
Fine. I think that's a useful sort of perspective to take when you're up against the practicalities of it. You've alluded briefly to relapsed or refractory disease, and given the overall poor prognosis, needless to say, this is sort of terrible news for the patient. Is there anything that's worth pursuing in that setting?
Yeah, it's extremely difficult, isn't it? And you know, if the chemo resistance rates are so high that further chemotherapy often feels futile, but it would depend on how much chemosensitivity has been demonstrated with your first line of therapy as to whether you consider pursuing more chemotherapy. Clinical trials has to be what we should be looking at if they're available. And but at the moment, in terms of targeted agents, so you know, we can't access mogamulizumab or lenalidomide unless through an early access or compassionate program. But again, they're better more for leukemic types and nodal disease. If there is CD30 expression, you could try compassionate access for brentuximab vedotin. So it's really difficult. We've just had some promising data, however, for an EZH1/2 inhibitor, vemetostat, which has just been reported. Showing quite promising response rates. We haven't got long-term follow-up. But whether that can continue to develop and achieve a European license, we'll have to see. But difficult space, certainly.
Thank you. Let's move on to a case of a 69-year-old man who had a background of high blood pressure, atrial fibrillation, and had had a previous stroke. He presented with facial swelling and enlarged cervical nodes clinically, and on a CT had a large sort of facial tumour indistinguishable from the parotid and sort of invading into local lymph nodes. He had a core biopsy which showed preserved sort of B follicles and T cell areas, but expansion of those T cell areas with predominantly CD4 cells. And that was felt to be equivocal. So he underwent an excision biopsy, showed a diffuse interfollicular infiltrate of medium-sized lymphocytes with irregular nuclei, again, CD4 cells with aberrant CD7 negativity, also CD10 positive, CD30 positive, EBV negative, and CD21 staining highlighted the preserved FTC meshworks within the B cell follicles. So looking like some sort of peripheral T cell lymphoma. Any other diagnostic tests that are key at this point?
So again, another example of the challenges with T cell lymphoma diagnostics. You know, repeat biopsies are not uncommon due to often significant stromal reactive cell infiltrate, low tumor burden and things. So we've discussed the importance of HLV1 and how I think that should be performed in all possible cases. I think in addition here, I mean, there's some further immunohistochemistry that a large lymphoma center would probably undertake. We've got CD10, but there are other markers of a particular type of CD4 T cell called T follicular helper cells, such as PD-1, ICOS, and BCL6. And I mention that because CD10 expression is quite a specific marker for T follicular helper T cells, and we know that some T cell lymphomas derive from this subset. Increasingly, and I think sometimes we forget this in T-cell lymphoma, there is a cancer test directory. There are now nationally, centrally commissioned mutational testing that we can all access through our genomic laboratory hubs. And there are relevant genes for T-cell lymphoma, not many, not enough, but you can test for TET2, DNMT3A, ROA, and IDH2. This would probably need discussion with your GLH because a lot of those genes are on myeloid panels and not lymphoid panels, and not everyone yet has ROA available. But just to be aware that there are some mutations that can support the diagnostic workup as well.
Presumably,
in terms of,
many of those associated with clonal hematopoiesis, as you say, and that there's a danger, I suppose, that you ascribe a background clonal hematopoiesis mutation and overinterpret it, but that needs to be borne in mind when making the
TET2 DNMT3A, that's absolutely right. But for ROA, G17V hotspot, and IDH2 R172 hotspot, these are specific hotspots that are strongly associated with lymphomas that derive from T follicular helper cells. In terms of additional testing, I do flow cytometry, lymphocyte subset analysis on the peripheral blood in all T-cell lymphoma cases. I like to know their CD4 count in terms of antimicrobial prophylactic decision-making. We know that a good proportion of AITL, angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma, have circulating cells as well. And so that could be helpful. So that's another test alongside clonality, which we haven't got on this lymph node yet.
So this patient's HTLV-1 serology was negative. As almost all hematology patients do, she underwent a bloodborne virus screen. And actually, that showed a sort of equivocal HIV serology result, but a negative HIV antigen test and subsequently negative PCR. They also had a positive DAT and normal lymphocyte subsets in the peripheral blood. So, in light of recent publications, what would the patient's diagnosis have been 3 months ago, and what will it be, say, 3 months down the line when we've decided what we're going to use going forward?
So historically, we had peripheral T-cell lymphoma not otherwise specified. And then we had angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma. And angioimmunoblastic is a constellation of several quite unique morphological appearances under the microscope, which hasn't been described in this case here. But increasingly, it's now been recognised that a proportion of peripheral T-cell, or what was peripheral T-cell NOS, express similar markers to angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma and have overlapping genetic landscapes, suggesting that they share a biology and that they share a cellular ontogeny. And we know now that angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma derive from these T follicular helper cells, which I alluded to earlier. And about 20 to 30% of peripheral T-cell lymphoma NOS also share that signature. So this has been increasingly recognized. There was a provisional entity in the 2016 WHO, which recognized an entity called nodal peripheral T-cell lymphoma with TFH phenotype. But that's just really been firmed up now recently with the publications of the ICC and the latest iteration of the WHO classification. And they've united the T-cell lymphoma nodal T-cell lymphomas that share this TFH derivation into a term called T follicular helper cell lymphoma. This appears to have a distinct biology. And just for detail, so the diagnosis could be TFH lymphoma, angioimmunoblastic T-cell lymphoma type, or TFH lymphoma not otherwise specified type. So you still have that morphological descriptor alongside it. And actually, your summary of the kind of immune findings, so the equivocal HIV serology, the positive DAT, is interesting. There does seem immune dysregulation appears to be a hallmark of T follicular helper lymphomas. And about 15 to 20% will have a DAT positive hemolysis, for example. you can often see small paraproteins, and that just reflects the dysregulation, the expansion of B cell clones. So, you know, it's an interesting facet of the biology.
And that's quite well described for AITL. Is it equally true of the phenotypic TFH-PTCLs?
So that work is less comprehensive because, you know, to date they've been considered quite differently. But certainly we have seen I've seen cases where the histological diagnosis has been NOS, but there's been clear evidence of immune dysregulation, positive DATs, and ultimately it's turned out that they've had more of the T follicular can help phenotype. So I think so to a degree.
Yeah. So this patient, in view of the AF and actually some suboptimal echocardiogram findings, was treated with TROC with a 50% dose doxorubicin and only had a partial response after two cycles and then had progressive disease after four cycles and ultimately passed away. As for many T-cell lymphomas, treatments aren't as effective as they are for B-cell lymphomas. Is there anything that is coming through the pipeline that we might give us grounds for optimism in a few years' time?
So at the moment, the, you know, CHOP remains our de facto standard, I think, for non-anaplastic large cell lymphoma nodal T-cell disease, which is unsatisfactory. I mean, in terms of emerging therapeutic landscapes, we've got some small molecule inhibitors, you know, that there's some interest around, so PI3 kinase, although there are some toxicity concerns there. I think some of the agents that may hold the greatest promise, kind of epigenetic modifiers, although the combination of romidepsin with CHOP did not show a clear benefit. Subgroup analysis suggests that T follicular help lymphomas may be more sensitive, but of course the trial did not take a precision medicine approach. It took all PTCL. And so I think that's really important. As we move forward, we need to be testing drugs rationally in biologically distinct cohorts. And of course, that's easier said than done. These are very rare diseases. It needs international collaboration. But azacitidine and oral azacitidine does have some interest, and we're just currently awaiting the results of a randomized phase 3 study, relapse refractory T follicular helper lymphoma. This is the first example of a large international clinical trial focusing simply on this biologically distinct cohort, and that was oral azacitidine versus investigator's choice, which I think for most UK sites was oral gemcitabine, and that's completed, and I understand we might be getting some data at ASH, which is very exciting. Checkpoint blockade does not appear to be effective, which is disappointing. We don't have a rituximab antibody equivalent for T-cell lymphomas. But there are some promising early evidence of feasibility, potentially activity and safety of CAR-T approaches. And there's some examples of that targeting CD5 and CD7. But potentially the one that's mechanistically more enticing is an anti-TRBC1 CAR, UCLH being the lead site for this, because your normal T cells are broadly split 40-60 across whether they are TRBC1 or TRBC2. These are your alpha beta T cells. So the CAR will only ablate, you know, half of your T cell repertoire. So, you know, that will hopefully mitigate toxicity. So I think these things are promising. There's a couple of bispecifics at very, very early stages of development. So I think, you know, some optimism, but there's a long way for us to go. And I think it's how we choose to test these drugs in the clinical trial setting that's going to be key.
Yeah, that's good to hear. I mean, I've tried to follow the CAR T-cell therapy for T-cell lymphomas literature, but yes, it's a difficult tightrope of toxicity and clever contortions to the biology.
Achieving that tumor specificity without ablating your entire T-cell repertoire is not straightforward.
So thank you very much, Dr. Ahern, for what's been really interesting, perhaps selective, but sort of rich tour through some of the T-cell lymphoma nuances. And I suspect we should probably do this again every 3 months for the next 5 years to be able to cover the whole series.
Yeah, Bernard, it's hard to cover. It's such a broad heterogeneous group, isn't it? It's very hard to cover it.
But I hope our listeners found it interesting and enriching for their practice. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Bernard.